This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, China says it has detained five more people in a security crackdown in the Xinjiang region. Seeking peace in Ukraine through dialogue, including Russia. Officials say they know where 200 schoolgirls are being held in Nigeria. Refugees reportedly denied cancer treatment for lack of funds. And a MERS meeting calls for urgent action. It's all ahead for you. I'm Susan Yawkey. China says it has detained five more people and seized nearly 2 tons of what it calls bomb-making material, just 2 days after announcing a one-year security crackdown in the western Xinjiang region. Local government officials today said two explosives-producing sites were also destroyed in a raid Monday. Sunday, state media quoted authorities claiming to have caught more than 200 suspects from nearly 2 dozen terror and religious extremist groups in May. Last week, the regional capital, Ürümqi, was the scene of a marketplace attack that killed 43 people and wounded more than 90. On April 30th, two attackers set off explosives and slashed passengers at an Ürümqi train station, killing one and wounding 79. On March 1st, 8 knife-wielding men attacked passengers at a train station in Yunnan province, killing 29 people in what state media described as China's 9/11. China has blamed the attacks on Uyghurs, a largely Muslim ethnic minority group that is native to Xinjiang. Uyghurs in China complain of religious and cultural discrimination. Senior resident fellow Michael Clark at Australia's Griffith Asia Institute tells VOA's Victor Beatty, the terrorists China is facing are likely radicalized Uyghurs, although outside groups cannot be discounted.
China has in the past simply labeled all violence and opposition in Xinjiang as being the result of terrorism, and in particular of the work of two organizations. The first is the East Turkestan Islamic Movement, and the second is the Turkestan Islamic Party. However, there has been little concrete proof that either of those organizations have carried out attacks within Xinjiang, although there is evidence that those two organizations do exist and are based in the tribal areas along the frontiers between Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Now, are these Uyghurs or are they Muslims who are sympathetic to the Uyghur cause?
Most probably it would be ethnic Uyghurs who have become radicalized and have returned to Xinjiang, but we should, of course, not discount the possibility, given the links of some of these groups to more globally minded terrorist organizations that haven't joined, in a sense, the fight against the Chinese state.
This one-year security crackdown announced last week by China, this obviously represents what they considered a serious challenge to domestic tranquility.
The fact that they've launched an explicitly Xinjiang-specific, almost targeted campaign against terrorism and against religious extremism does suggest the seriousness with which the threat is taken. And in that context, in terms of the seriousness of the threat, we have to recall here that the latest events, I mean, since the Kunming attack on the 1st of March and then the first two Ürümqi attacks and now this latest incident of arrests in Hotan sort of demonstrates an escalation in the level and potential scope of the threat to China's position in the region.
Why would China put a one-year cap on this security crackdown?
There is precedent in Xinjiang's recent past for this. Throughout the late 1990s, authorities instituted rolling yearly so-called strike hard campaigns that were directed against separatists and extremists in the region. So in a sense, the current campaign has a precedent. Yet the innovation, in a sense, is that it has been stated by the authorities that this is a nationwide campaign against terrorism.
Ahmed Salah Hashim, Associate Professor of Strategic Studies at Singapore's Nanyang Technological University, says China's counter-terrorism response so far has been inadequate.
When the violence started, they announced strike-hard policies and mixed with palliative measures, like stating that they will implement economic and social development programs and integrate the Uyghur population more effectively, and also deal with incidents, sort of uncivility by PLA units and the PAP police units. But I think the outbreak, the increased number of attacks, as well as the fact that they're not able to get much in the way of human intelligence about them, has really shaken them quite a bit. And despite the heavy presence of security in Xinjiang, it's been quite ineffective in gathering information about the Uyghur militants, and in fact building an effective intelligence overview of what groups who are doing this, what they are, what do they want, and so on. In light of the latest attack in the marketplace, they may actually change tack and try and bring in better trained units, special operations units, and try to get more and better information in order to build a better intelligence picture.
Right now, you consider their counterterrorism efforts inadequate at this point?
Yes, totally inadequate. Just having a heavy-handed presence in a place does not make for effective counterterrorism. You have to be proactive, both militarily as well as in terms of economic as well as social palliative measures, as well as trying to reach out to the Uyghur population.
Hashim says there are many reasons for the rise of extremism in China. A lot of it, he says, has to do with social and economic discontent, along with a heavy security presence in Xinjiang. But he also says China is more open to outside influences, especially in Xinjiang, which borders more democratic Central Asian countries and is close to Islamic militancy in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Hashim also says China's military is not yet well-trained to deal with counterinsurgency, having long focused on high-tech, state-to-state conventional warfare. Thailand's junta has summoned and detained activists and academics in the week it assumed power in a coup. The military says it is carrying out a reform agenda aimed at solving the country's more than six-month-long political impasse. Gabrielle Palouk reports from Bangkok.
Since Thailand's new military junta, the National Peace and Order Maintaining Council, seized power, anti-coup protesters have been gathering by the hundreds in Bangkok at impromptu flash mobs organized by text message and social networking apps. Troops have been sent to confront protesters and clear the streets, and on occasion have arrested demonstrators for defying the ban on such rallies. The junta has also summoned members of the ousted government, activists, and academics, detaining many of them indefinitely at an undisclosed location. Most have obeyed the orders and reported to military offices, but a few, such as pro-government redshirt activist Sombat Bunyangamong, rejected the instructions. Instead, Sombat said authorities could find him at a Bangkok McDonald's, where a flash mob of protesters wearing masks bearing the image of his face had gathered. Chatupon was one member of the masked mob who said the group's tactics come after many of their political leaders have been rounded up.
Because Sombat, like, I make a game for everyone. If you want to catch him, just go ahead, catch him everywhere. We are everywhere. Just like a, you know, event, flat mob or something like that. And then decide, catch me if you... Actually, because the soldier want to step, want to beat us, like underground, something like that, want to be under the ground, that's why they want to catch all the leader. They got some already. They got our prime minister.
In addition to Sombat, the military has summoned and detained journalists and academics, as well as political leaders opposing the coup. Coup leader and Chief General Prayut Chan-o-cha says he hopes military rule will bring an end to Thailand's protracted political crisis, which saw the democratically elected government and the opposition unable to reach a compromise and resulted in months of demonstrations that paralyzed the capital. Deputy Army spokesperson Wirachon Sukonda Patipak says the army will relinquish administrative control over the country once it has solved its problems. The spokesperson promised detained political leaders would be released once order had returned to the streets, but did not specify what would happen to other detainees. Pavin Chachaval Pongpun is a political analyst and former diplomat among those summoned by the junta, but he says he did not respond because he says he does not recognize the legitimacy of the coup. He says the summons are a breach against academic freedom and an attempt at intimidation.
This is the 19 coup, military coup, but I mean the fact that they started harass academy. This is something quite new. You know, the first thing to do is for them to try to control what kind of message that, you know, many people would be sending across. And I think academic could pose as a potential threat to the power position of the coup makers, obviously.
He believes the process of summoning outspoken people with the looming threat of future prosecution under martial law or lèse majesté law undermines the legitimacy of the coup. Pavan says it will only encourage critics of the military regime. This has been Gabrielle Paluch reporting from Bangkok for VOA News.
Petro Poroshenko took the majority of votes in Ukraine's Sunday presidential election and Monday said there will be no talks with terrorists, his word for the armed pro-Russian separatists in the east. Mr. Poroshenko said that peace can be reached through dialogue, including Russia.
Russia is our biggest neighbor. And because of the fact that stopping the war and bringing the peace to the whole Ukraine and bringing stability on the eastern part of Ukraine, that would be impossible without participation of Russian representative.
A Ukrainian rebel leader in Donetsk said he's also ready to talk with Poroshenko, but only if the talks concern a prisoner swap and pulling Ukrainian forces out of the east. Jamie Detmer reports European observers say Sunday's presidential election in Ukraine largely met international standards.
It was one of the largest election observation teams European authorities have assembled to monitor an election. More than 1,000 observers were fielded by the Organisation for European Security and Cooperation, or OSCE. And the head of the mission, Joao Soares, along with European parliamentarians, gave his verdict.
As you have heard, the international observers recognise these elections as proper and decent.
The Portuguese politician decried the sabotage of the elections by separatists in Ukraine's two easternmost provinces, Donetsk and Luhansk, where pro-Russian insurgents managed to stop any voting in 24 out of 34 polling districts. But he insisted that the outcome of the vote should be respected, noting that the turnout of 60% across the country was higher than the turnout for Sunday's European parliamentary polls in 27 countries.
Of course, there were problems in Donetsk and in Luhansk, but the turnout in all Ukraine is much better than the turnout of the same election that occurred in the same day to the European Parliament. I am a member of the European Union. I've been in the European Parliament. I would be very proud to have this turnout in my own elections.
It remains unclear still how many Easterners did manage to vote. One estimate on Sunday by Ukraine's election commission put the turnout at 9% in Donetsk, where separatists abducted election officials, threatened poll workers, and forced the closure of polling stations. The OSCE, the main outside group monitoring Sunday's presidential race, said the election was characterized by high turnout and the clear resolve of authorities to hold what was a genuine election, largely in line with international commitments and with respect for fundamental freedoms. The OSCE report also says voting and counting procedures were transparent and the candidates were able to campaign freely. It notes that at 98% of polling stations observed outside eastern Ukraine, voting was orderly and well organised. But the OSCE says that the early tabulation of the vote was at times chaotic, partly because of a virus buried by separatists in the Election Commission's computer system. For all of the problems in the East, European parliamentarians said the fact that billionaire Petro Poroshenko won on an outright victory in the first round of voting, doing away with the need for a June runoff, illustrates the legitimacy of his election, proving that he is backed by most of the country. Swiss politician Andreas Gross says the separatists failed to undermine the vote's legitimacy.
You know, legitimacy is a product of an election which is a nationwide effort. And you can't hinder in two provinces some people not to go to vote with the hope that you can undermine the legitimacy of the outcome of a national vote.
The European politicians say they hope Poroshenko can launch talks to heal national divisions and to resolve the insurgency in the east. But dialogue may be all the harder after separatists seized Donetsk airport Sunday night, prompting an airstrike Monday by the Ukrainian military. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Kiev.
A top military official in Nigeria says they know where more than 200 schoolgirls are being held captive by Islamist militants. Chief of Defense Staff Air Marshal Alex Bada spoke to reporters in Abuja.
The good news for the girls is that we know where they are, but we cannot tell you. Okay, we cannot come and tell you military secrets here. Just leave us alone. We are working. We will get the girls back.
He said a military operation could be dangerous for the girls. Bada added, we can't kill our girls in the name of trying to get them back. The girls were kidnapped in mid-April while taking exams in a secondary school in the remote northern village of Chibok. Militants from the Islamist group Boko Haram claim responsibility for the kidnappings. The UN Refugee Agency says hundreds of refugees in Jordan and Syria are being denied cancer treatment because of a lack of funds. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency says the number of refugees with cancer is overwhelming health systems in Jordan and Syria. UNHCR's top medical expert, Paul Spiegel, tells VOA decisions on who gets treatment and who does not are made on the basis of cost. He says helping the largest number of people with the limited amount of money on hand is usually the determining factor.
For the colleagues themselves that have to deal with this, it is extremely, extremely difficult. And we sometimes try to help them, to give them counseling. We have a standard operating procedure that can be shared with both the doctors and the refugees to say, this is what happens. And we do this in order to help the most amount of people. But no matter which way you look at it, it's a horrible experience.
A new UNHCR study tracks refugee cancer cases in Jordan and Syria from 2009 to 2012. It says the number of cases in the region is rising because there are more refugees and more people fleeing middle-income countries such as Syria. The UNHCR has set up an exceptional care committee which decides whether to fund expensive treatments. The study finds the most common form of cancer among refugees is breast cancer, accounting for almost one quarter of all applications in Jordan. Of 511 cancer cases, Dr. Spiegel says fewer than half were approved for treatment between 2010 and 2012. He says treatment is usually denied to patients with little chance of recovery.
So that the treatment would not actually prolong the life or prolong for a very short period of time, 6 months, and would be very expensive, to someone like this would be denied. Because, again, I know it sounds heartless and it's a very difficult decision, but with a limited amount of money, we can ensure that we can treat people where we can hopefully cure the cancer, or at least what's called a functional cure, so that they will have at least 5 more years and hopefully a lifetime.
Dr. Spiegel notes many hospitals in Syria have been destroyed or closed by conflict. He says it is likely many Syrians with serious health problems choose to leave the country more in hopes of getting treated for their illnesses than out of security concerns. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
With more than 600 cases and nearly 200 deaths, officials are calling for greater monitoring and investigation of MERS, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. The call came following a meeting of experts Monday in Oman. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The UN Food and Agriculture Organization convened the meeting of international health and veterinary authorities. Juan Lubroth is the FAO's chief veterinary officer.
It begins like an influenza, and it involves multiple organs, and the patient usually has a fever, and they could be organ failure and die. So it's a very serious disease.
MERS is caused by the coronavirus, which is found in some animals, such as camels and bats. Right now, much of the investigation is focusing on dromedary camels. But Lubroth says although the animals carry the virus, there's no evidence yet it makes them sick.
We do see that camels probably had this virus infection or something very similar, if not identical to it, for decades. But we haven't seen the spillover event before. So something has changed. Something has changed in agricultural practices or livestock production. Maybe the virus has changed a little bit. So we don't quite know how humans are becoming infected.
Cases of MERS peaked in April and May of 2013, and again during the same 2 months this year. However, it's not known why. Despite the name, the disease has been found outside the Gulf region, including North Africa, some Western nations, and in Asia. But Lubroth says the human infections were traced back to travel through the Middle East region.
So there is some risk associated there that we don't quite fully understand. But I think this highlights the importance of international travel and the spread of pathogens. Globalization, trade, climate change. These are all things that we need to keep in mind.
The FAO chief veterinary officer says experts are still trying to determine how MERS spreads.
From the animal source, we don't know. From the human source, we do see that most human cases are attributable to contact with diseased people at the hospital, at the clinic, maybe with their home, in close contact with family members. So one thing that should be recommended is good hygiene practices, particularly with those individuals that are handling animals.
Public health and veterinary officials from 11 countries attended the meeting in Oman. They recommended immediate investment in research and surveillance of animals, tighter biosecurity measures at farms and border crossings, greater sharing and coordination of information about MERS, and the involvement of animal racing associations, breeding companies, and meatpacking operations. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
China is a fascinating country
with interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio
and anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia.
President Obama has paid tribute to America's war dead as the United States marked Memorial Day. VOA's Michael Bowman reports.
Hours after completing a whirlwind trip to visit U.S. troops in Afghanistan, President Barack Obama laid a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier in Arlington National Cemetery just across the Potomac River from Washington. Moments later, Mr. Obama noted the ultimate sacrifices made by generations of Americans from the nation's founding to the present day.
Everything that we hold precious in this country was made possible by Americans who gave their all. And because of them, our nation is stronger, safer, and will always remain a shining beacon of freedom for the rest of the world.
The president paid special tribute to the widow of a soldier who went missing during the Korean War and who waited more than 60 years for her husband's remains to be found and returned for burial in the United States. Mr. Obama noted that 2014 marks the final year of combat for American forces in Afghanistan and the 150th anniversary of the founding of Arlington National Cemetery. Next month marks 70 years since U.S. troops stormed the beaches at Normandy, France during World War II. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
In football news, Nigeria has undergone a significant transformation over the last two seasons, winning the first African Cup of Nations title last year. Coach Stephen Kashiu has sought to lower the average age of his squad, and despite controversy frequently surrounding his selection policy, his methods have been successful. Nosa Igbor is a midfielder for the Nigerian Super Eagles.
I think, now in Nigeria, they want to raise like a new team with young boys. The guys in 2002 and 1994, those were older guys. But now even in Nigerians, they want to like raise football from the grassroots, and it's like younger players in the national team. In the national team back then, you can't get a player of 20 years old, 19 years old, but now we have it. So it's like from the grassroots, and that's the most important thing of all.
This year will be a fifth World Cup appearance for Nigeria, and Ingeborg believes that their status as African champions should give his teammates plenty of confidence heading to Brazil.
We're going to the World Cup to really prove to people, you understand, that we got the boys, and I'm hoping and I'm praying that we get to the semifinals.
Nigeria will open their World Cup play against Iran on June 16th before facing Bosnia and Argentina on the 21st and 25th of June, respectively. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On May 27, 1703, Russian Tsar Peter the Great, having recaptured land controlled by Sweden, ordered construction of a city on the site of a former Swedish fortress along the banks of the Neva River. That city would become St. Petersburg and for two centuries would serve as the Russian capital. In 1905, the Japanese fleet began a battle that destroyed Russia's East Sea Fleet in the Straits of Tsushima. It was the decisive battle of the Russo-Japanese War and marked the first time that radio transmissions played an important role in a naval engagement. It was also the first defeat of a European power by an Asian nation. On this day in 1941, the British Navy sank the German battleship the Bismarck in the North Atlantic near France. British Prime Minister Winston Churchill had ordered the sinking of the German ship after it had managed to sink the HMS Hood, the flagship and pride of the Royal Navy. More than 2,000 crew members were killed in the sinking of the Bismarck. And on this day in 1957, Brunswick Records released That'll Be the Day, a song that would become the first hit for Buddy Holly and the Crickets.
Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave, you know it's a lie, 'cause that'll be the day when I die.
Buddy Holly died in a plane crash in Iowa when he was just 22 years old, but his body of work is considered among the most influential in rock music history. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave, you know it's a...
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is my fifth trip to Asia as president, and I plan to be back again later this year, U.S. President Barack Obama said recently at a Young Southeast Asian Leaders Initiative town hall meeting in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, because I made a deliberate and strategic decision that America will play a larger, more comprehensive role in this region's future. From America's earliest years, when the first president, George Washington, sent a trade mission to China, through last year, when the aircraft carrier that bears his name, the George Washington, helped with typhoon relief in the Philippines, America has always had a history with Asia. And we've got a future with Asia, President Obama said, because Asia is home to more than half of humanity. Asia will largely define the contours of the century ahead, whether marked by conflict or cooperation, by human suffering or human progress. This is why America has refocused our attention on the vast potential of the Asia-Pacific region. We have been moving forward on our rebalance to Asia by opening ties of commerce and negotiating the Trans-Pacific Partnership, by increasing our defense and educational exchange cooperation and modernizing our alliances, by participating fully in regional institutions like the East Asia Summit, building deeper partnerships with emerging powers like Indonesia, Malaysia, and Vietnam, he said. Our strategy is more than just security alliances or trade agreements, he said. It's also about building genuine relationships between the peoples of Asia and the peoples of the United States, especially young people. We're launching a new Young Southeast Asian Leaders Initiative to increase and enhance America's engagement with young people across the region, he continued. Together, we want to make the Asia-Pacific more prosperous. Together, we want to make the Asia-Pacific cleaner and more secure. Together, we can make this world more just, President Obama said. We need to build together in partnership with all the nations and peoples of the region, especially young people. That vision is within our reach if we're willing to work for it.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.